Good afternoon. I'm going to read a passage from John chapter 10. John chapter 10, starting verse 1. Most assuredly, I say to you, he who does not enter the sheepfold by the door, but climbs up some other way, the same is a thief and a robber. But he who enters by the door is the shepherd of the sheep. To him the doorkeeper opens, and the sheep hear his voice, and he calls his own sheep by name and leads them out. And when he brings out his own sheep, he goes before them, and the sheep follow him, for they know his voice. Yet they will by no means follow a stranger, but will flee from him, for they do not know the voice of strangers. Jesus used this illustration, but they did not understand the things which he spoke to them. Then Jesus said to them again, Most surely I say to you, I am the door of the sheep. All whoever came before me are thieves and robbers, but the sheep did not hear them. I am the door. If anyone enters by me, he will be saved, and will go in and out and find pasture. The thief does not come except to steal and to kill and to destroy. I have come that they may have life, and that they may have it more abundantly. I am the good shepherd. The good shepherd gives his life for the sheep. But a hireling, he is not the shepherd, one who does not own the sheep, sees the wolf coming and leaves the sheep and flees. And the wolf catches the sheep and scatters them. And the hireling flees because he is a hireling and does not care about the sheep. I am the good shepherd, and I know my sheep, and am known by my own. As the Father knows me, even so I know the Father, and I lay down my life for the sheep. And other sheep I have which are not of this fold, them also I must bring, and they will hear my voice, and there will be one flock and one shepherd. Therefore my Father loves me, because I lay down my life, that I may take it up again. No one takes it from me, but I lay it down to myself. I have power to lay it down, and I have power to take it again. This command I have received from my Father. Therefore there was a division again among the Jews because of these sayings, and many of them said, He has a demon and is mad. Why do you listen to him? Others said, These are not the words of one who has a demon. Can a demon open the eyes of the blind? Now it was the feast of dedication in Jerusalem, and it was winter, and Jesus walked in the temple in Solomon's porch. Then the Jews surrounded him and said to him, How long do you keep us in doubt? If you are the Christ, tell us plainly. Jesus said to them, I told you, and you do not believe. The works that I do in my Father's name, they bear witness of me. But you do not believe, because you are not of my sheep, as I said to you. My sheep hear my voice, and I know them, and they follow me. And I give them eternal life, and they shall never perish, neither shall anyone snatch them out of my hand. My Father has given them to me. My Father who has given them to me is greater than all, and no one is able to snatch them out of my Father's hand. I and my Father are one. Our meeting has a theme this weekend, if you haven't noticed, and I have a unique assignment, and that is to talk about shepherding in the Bible without making any spiritual applications whatsoever, because other people are going to be covering those things. I'm just kidding. I don't have to be that picky, I don't think. But we are going to take a look at shepherding the Bible, and it is interesting that this passage here is perhaps one of the best ones about what we know about shepherding, because actually, from what we can tell, shepherding actually hasn't changed all that much in the thousands of years that it's been in existence, at least according to my research that I did for this lesson. As far as what we know about sheep and sheep herding, the Hebrew word for sheep or flock is S-O-apostrophe-N, usually pronounced shown or something like that. And it literally means small cattle. And that's the way that it's presented to us in the Bible, is that any type of livestock herding can be can follow basically the same rules. In Genesis chapter 4, we get the impression, at least I do, as far as Cain and Abel goes, that Abel was a herder of domesticated sheep, or at least some type of livestock similar to that. And I would guess, since God often has requirements of us, that God also gave them the knowledge and the tools that they needed in order to domesticate these animals and tend to them and herd them. I don't know of a time where God asked someone to do something and left it up to them to figure it out on their own. So God probably equipped them to domesticate these animals and trained them in the arts of herding them and breeding them and so on, caring for them, etc., etc. Abel was doing what he was supposed to, and Cain, I take it, we can gather, was not doing what he was supposed to. God was requiring these animals for, if nothing else, sacrifice, and probably they needed to use them for many other things, as people always have. But God taught, in my view, probably taught, them how to be shepherds. And it's interesting that after the post-flood, after the flood came, the post-flood world and what we can learn about it, the archaeology of it, confirms that the oldest settlements in Central Asia, at least what seemed to be the oldest settlements after the flood, sheep and goats were the first animals that are associated with these sites that people can say clearly were domesticated. My contention is that these animals were domesticated before the flood, and then after the flood, they just started herding them again until they start showing up in the archaeological record. Cows came shortly after that, and then horses, etc., etc. But sheep and goats were, seems to be, the first animals that were domesticated by humans. And I believe that was before the flood. I believe God gave us the tools and the knowledge, the wherewithal, on how to do that. There were five breeds that were known in the patriarchal era in Mesopotamia and Syria and Palestine. And they came in various sizes. They had different uses and features to them, but the one that was most common in Syria and in the land of Canaan, which was probably used and cultivated by the Hebrews as well, was what's called the fat-tailed variety. I had no idea about this, because I don't know anything about sheep or sheep herding. But this fat-tailed variety, the tail by itself on a large adult male could weigh up to 30 pounds. That's remarkable. And if you go, it gives perhaps some insight into Exodus 29 and 22, which mentions these fat tails. It told them what parts of the animal to carve up and what was appropriate for what. And it mentions these fat tails. And I never could figure out what a fat tail was. But it was a particular variety of sheep that was most common in use among the Hebrews and the Canaanites. And this particular tail was useful to them in many ways, especially the fat. Excuse me. As far as their taxonomy goes, sheep are considered a breed of cloven-hoofed ruminant similar to cattle. In fact, they're taxonomically related to cattle, scientifically. And so when the Bible refers to cattle, particularly early on in the book of Genesis and so forth, it just means these types of animals. It's a general expression for these ruminants, of which cattle and sheep belong, and some other wild animals. And these appear to have been the only animals that were permissible for food, at least early on. And at least commonly available as well. These animals were suitable for food, but also for sacrifice, which, like I said, seems to be the reason for their domestication in the first place. You may recall that as soon as Adam and Eve sinned, what did they clothe themselves with? But plant life, plant matter. That was what they knew. That was what they tended to. It seems to be the case anyway. And so when God saw that and saw that it was unsuitable to cover their nakedness, he showed them these dead animals, which we're not told exactly what those were, but I can imagine animals like this that were suitable for sacrifice, and their sheep's, their skin, their leather or whatever, being suitable also for clothing. So right from the get-go, Adam and Eve had the impression, this is probably the first things that they had seen that had ever died, so they had the impression that their sin led directly to the death of these poor, dumb animals who didn't do anything wrong. So what's the lesson there for us but that it's going to take something virgin, something pure, something clean, without blemish, in order to cover our sin? That's one of the first things they learn about. One of the other things that's evident from the Bible and reading the Old Testament in particular is that agriculture, of course, was fundamental and basic to every one of these ancient economies. No matter how civilized or cultured some of these ancient countries we read about in the Bible were, they were always agrarian based. So that was going to be 90 to 95 to 98% of what we would consider their economy. Livestock herding, including shepherding, would have been about a third to 50% of that, depending on the local conditions, what you could grow there, etc., etc. So this was a major part of everybody's life. And what's interesting is everybody knew something about livestock herding and shepherding in particular, just depending on where you were and what time period. So flocks were a fundamental part of everyday people's lives. Even if you weren't a quote-unquote sheep-breeding person, you probably had some. And this was pretty common in American husbandry and cultivation as well. You go to any farm where they, you know, farm corn or wheat or whatever, it wasn't uncommon to also find some milk cows and some goats and sheep, etc. So most people were familiar with these animals and how to raise them and care for them. The patriarch's wealth that we read of in the book of Genesis onward, their wealth was measured by the size of their flocks and herds. Not only were these necessary for food, but also the byproducts of these animals were a major part, and probably the major part of the economy, mostly for wool, but other parts were used as well. The hollow horns, and all these ruminants, cows and sheep, have hollow horns. Their horns were hollow, and once they were cut off, they could be used for liquid storage, especially oils, ointments, salves, and things like that. And they also could be used for instruments. They were used also to be blown during battle to send signals and things like that. If you've read anything about the Native Americans and their relationship to the bison of the American plains, you learn that they used almost every single part of that animal. And that was the same with the ancient people and sheep and cattle as well. And they were very productive and industrious in the use of these animals. There was very little that went unused or was wasted. As I was looking through some books some time ago, I had nothing to do. This was a year or two ago. I was reading about some other cultures from Mesopotamia in the time period, probably shortly after the Tower of Babel. And I came across a series of kings and governors that served under them, and they all compared themselves to shepherds. And I thought that was interesting, and when I wrap this lesson up, I'll come back to that. But the virtues and qualities of a good shepherd were well known in the ancient world. Now, these kings, most of them were pagans, almost all of them were pagans. And to their enemies, they wanted to be seen as terrors and scourges of God, or the gods, if you will. But to their own people, they preferred to be viewed as shepherds and or father figures, something along those lines. So the qualities that made someone a good shepherd were well known and well respected. These tended to be some of the best people and men that most anybody would know. And as we go through, we'll take a look at some of those things. But shortly after what I think is would have been the Babel incident, there was a king called Lugal-zaggisi of Uman, and he ended up conquering a city called Uruk. And in the Bible, in the Old Testament, that's called Erech. You may recall from the Tower of Babel around that time period. He prayed that he would be the foremost shepherd of his people. The foremost shepherd. Well, this is similar in nature to being called the chief shepherd or the ultimate shepherd. A governor sometime later named Gudea of Lagash was described by someone else as the faithful shepherd. So we see that these qualities of being foremost or out in the front, a leader, was prized among the ancient peoples, but also, and this one in particular, is that of the faithful shepherd. We'll talk a little bit more about that as we go through. But there were qualities that were understood universally by all these sheep herding cultures, that the virtues of the good shepherd were desirable. And this is true no matter how pagan they were or how atheistic societies they were. They all agreed that the shepherd's qualities of loyalty to his flock, gentleness, kindness, perseverance, wisdom, courage, self-sacrifice, etc., etc. These are all regarded as virtues by almost all ancient peoples that had any virtue whatsoever. Every king wanted to try to emulate these things, at least in the eyes of his people, because why? This is what we as followers and sheep gravitate ourselves towards. These are the qualities we used to look for in leaders in this country. I hope we still do. Wisdom. Someone who's been there before, someone who's willing to put them out front and take the slings and arrows, someone who's willing to give their life for their sheep. These are the things that people look for in their leaders, someone who's not only been around and done that, but has a proven track record of giving themselves up on behalf of other people. Because as we learn outside the Bible, sheep are virtually helpless on their own. Shepherds are responsible for the survival and welfare of their flock. Now, sheep and goats are very similar, taxonomically and biologically. When you look at their bone structure and everything, there's usually only a handful of bones that biologists can use to tell the difference between them. Sometimes when they find them in sacrificial hordes or whatever, they literally can't tell the difference between the goats and the sheep. But when you're looking at sheep and goats out in a field or pasture, goats will tend to fend for themselves. They're much more capable than sheep, which I found to be kind of funny. They're much more capable of taking care of themselves. They're not as fearful as sheep. They're much more independent natured. They hang out in smaller groups than sheep will. But sheep depend solely on the shepherd to find them good pasture. And if you're familiar with the 23rd Psalm, they have to be led to this pasture, and they also require quiet or still water. They're disturbed by running water or rushing water. So you have to find them water that is not moving, otherwise it freaks them out, because they are so skittish. So they are utterly dependent on the shepherd to find them these things and to lead them there. If rainfall and in the time period and in the place where the Bible, most of the Bible takes place, rainfall was lacking in the summertime. So you would get the early and the late rains, then you'd have this period, I guess, that we would call summer. And so it forced these shepherds to be very nomadic in their wandering. So when you get to Joseph, for instance, and he's going to look for his brothers, and they're all the way down from Hebron to Dothan, which is, I don't know, 60, 70 miles. So these shepherds would have to be able to range their sheep for quite a long way in order to get them to the pastures and water and to move around that way. So it was an itinerant lifestyle. They lived in tents, typically woven from black goat hair, which could be woven tight enough to be virtually waterproof. They wore rough homespun garments that were very rugged and would last at least the season. They carried all of their food in a leather pouch, and the sheep would supply their milk, for instance. The shepherds carried a rod that had a lot of purposes and uses. It was a walking stick, it was a shepherding tool, and it was also a weapon. Most shepherds, it seems, also learned how to use a slingshot. This stuff's starting to sound familiar. They were typically younger men. This was something you did as you were a young man trying to prove yourself. Once you got to a certain age or a certain station in life, these more onerous duties were taken from you, which is why we see David out shepherding in the early part of his story, and his brothers are not. That was another thing, that during times of war, shepherding became a minimal activity, where typically there would be one shepherd for every 100 sheep. Does that also sound familiar? So one shepherd for 100 sheep was about ideal, but during a time of war, you might pull a dude's six older brothers to war, and they were also shepherds, so you had one shepherd for 600 sheep. Well, this is when dogs and other things came into being, but they tried to limit this time period of warfare to one short season each year. You'll recall when David had his incident with Bathsheba, what time of the year did that take place? Well, it says when it was the time of the year where kings go to war. That was the campaign season. It was a short, dry season between what we would call spring and fall. So they would try to limit the activities of men during this time, because sheep herding was such an integral part of daily life for the entire nation. Shepherding was lonely and isolated. So, something I guess that might be human nature, but also had a benefit for the sheep, and that is they would spend a lot of time talking to their sheep. So this concept of the sheep knowing his voice starts coming into play. The sheep would come to know his voice and trust it without any further qualification. Once they heard their shepherd's voice, they could even identify his whistle from the whistle of other shepherds. Once they heard him shout, call, or whistle for them, they would immediately stop eating or drinking, and they would head towards where his voice was coming from. He did this by constantly talking to them. Some people will talk just to to prevent themselves from going crazy in that type of isolation. This seems like a natural human endeavor, just to make friends with these animals. At night, it wasn't uncommon, however, for several shepherds who were in an area to band together and keep their sheep in one place. This way that they could each sleep in watches. And most everything we read about in John chapter 10 at the beginning of this lesson applies to this type of situation. Now, there were all kinds of sheepfolds. Some of them were permanent, and these would be stone or brick-type structures. But as often as not, these were, if you've seen those boma walls in Africa that some of the villagers will build around their cities and villages to keep lions out, it'd be something like that, a thistle-like structure. And there was only one door, and guess who was that door? It was the shepherd. So when Jesus is talking in John chapter 10 there, he says, "I am the door." What he's saying is, "I am the guardian. I'm the only thing between this portal where the sheep are vulnerable that can keep them safe." So the shepherd would plant himself right at this door, and that's what kept the sheep safe. There are lots of reasons for keeping sheep in the folds. One was to keep them together, keep them warm, etc., etc. But the main thing was to keep them safe from hunters and robbers, etc., etc. So the shepherd's duty was to place himself at risk on behalf of his sheep, and any shepherd worth his salt would do this. So at night, these shepherds might gather them together, sometimes four, sometimes five or six flocks. Well, what happens when all these sheep get in one fold? Well, they mingle. How do you get them separated? Well, the shepherds would all part, and they'd just start whistling or calling, and the sheep would separate themselves, because each sheep knows its shepherd's voice and would follow the voice of their shepherd. So that was never actually any type of problem for them. Several times daily, the shepherds would count their sheep. And this was, I won't say the most fascinating, but it was something I didn't know beforehand. But it's this. The shepherds tended to name each individual sheep, and they could tell the difference between the sheep. So they might know this sheep as George, for instance. They wouldn't name any other of the 100 sheep that they might be responsible for. They wouldn't name any other one George. But he knew George intimately. He knew if, you know, by a scar or the shape of his horn, maybe had an odd-shaped horn or hoof or whatever. He would know each one of these intuitively, just like you know every single one of your family members. And as we see in John 10, verse 3, he could call each of them by name. He knew each of them on sight. He knew all of them individually. That is why, I'm going to go ahead and turn to Zechariah chapter 11. Now, there's a lot going on in the book of Zechariah. I'm not going to do an exegesis of that, but he does compare a few things to sheep and shepherds in these passages here. And one thing he's upset about is the leadership that his people have gotten. So I'll start in verse 1 of chapter 11. "Open your doors, O Lebanon, that fire may devour your cedars. Wail, O Cyprus, for the cedar has fallen, because the mighty trees are ruined. Wail, O oaks of Bashan, for the thick forest has come down. There is the sound of wailing shepherds, for their glory is in ruins. There is the sound of roaring lions, for the pride of the Jordan is in ruins. Thus says the Lord my God, feed the flock for slaughter, whose owners slaughter them and feel no guilt." I had never really thought about that passage before. Why should an owner of sheep feel guilty for slaughtering? Well, that's because very rarely did they actually use sheep for food. It was very rare to actually use these sheep for food. Once a sheep had got older, then you might kill it and skin it and etc., etc. But for the most part, these animals were raised for their wool and their milk, things that could be continually reproduced. And any owner who was so thoughtless as to slaughter his sheep so short-sightedly for merriment or whatever was deemed a pitiable owner indeed, a pitiful owner, someone that was uncaring about his flock. This was almost like It's almost like when you find out a restaurant serves dog, and you're like, "Oh, how could you do that? I love my dogs." Well, it's a cultural thing for sure, because there are countries where dogs are just animals that are fine to eat. But here we tend to grow up with this idea that dogs are friends, and this gives a little nuance, I think, to some of the things we learn about in the Old Testament. One is, you'll recall the Passover lamb. The Passover lamb was a lamb that was supposed to be perfect, and of course it represents Christ. What were they supposed to do with the Passover lamb leading up to the Feast of Unleavened Bread and then the Passover itself? This was an animal that they brought into their home and they treated like a family member. Exactly like a family member. So they were supposed to love and care for this animal, just like they would any other member of their family. Turn back to John 10 real quick. When Jesus says, "I am known by my own and I know all their names," etc., etc., they would have given this animal, more than likely, they would have given this animal a name. They would have treated it like a member of family. They would have cared for it. And this is exactly the same relationship that a shepherd tended to have with his entire flock. We have to remember that by the time we get to the Exodus, most of these people probably hadn't shepherded anything in generations. So bringing an animal in was the closest thing they could get to this type of relationship. But they were actually supposed to care for this animal. And you know as well as I do that people can be weird about animals. Now, I have a dog. You know, I love it, I guess. But I'm not really going to cry when it passes on. It lived a good life, and in some ways I'm looking forward to that day. But you know how some people can get with their animals, and I totally get that. I'm sympathetic with it. And this is something that they were supposed to care for a great deal. So when they made this sacrifice, it was a bona fide sacrifice. Because we kind of view meat and animals, you know, like something at a grocery store. It's all industrial and, you know, food lot produced, and we just see this slab. There's no soul there. There's no emotion there. There's been no provision on our part. But these were animals that they actually had to take care of. So Jesus sends his perfect Lamb of God, and his people are supposed to take care of it, because who is he? He's their Messiah. But then, of course, he ends up being rejected by his own. They did not care for this particular Passover lamb. But a shepherd would have known all of these animals intimately. He would have binded their wounds. He would have strengthened the weak. He would have tended to their infirmities. He would have carried them on his shoulders at times when they couldn't keep up with the rest of the flock. He never abandoned a single one of these animals. And it was expected that he would die for any one of them. That's what being a good shepherd was. And that's interesting to think about, because these guys would be out in basically the wild for long stretches of time. Well, you can imagine that there might be times that got quite desperate. They ran out of food. They ran out of water. Here's these animals that you can eat. He wasn't supposed to touch them, ever. He wasn't supposed to ever eat any of these animals, because they were his flock. He was intimately connected to these animals. So when these people actually came, when it came time for these people to sacrifice, this actually carried emotional weight for them. It meant something to them. And I kind of imagine that when Adam and Eve were looking at the dead animal that was a result of their sin. They had never seen anything die before. And these might have been animals that they had encountered before. Maybe they gave him names. It says that Adam gave the animals names. So that had to have carried some emotional weight for them, that there was indeed a consequence for sin. Something that you cared about was going to have to die because of the mistake you had made. As far as dogs go, when there were bad times, they did use dogs related to shepherding, but they didn't have sheep dogs the way we think of them. Dogs were only used to guard. They didn't help herd the animals. The shepherd was completely responsible for that. But it does seem that when you hear about packs of dogs or read about packs of dogs in the Bible, those are during bad times when there had been some depopulation. And these dogs that used to have jobs helping shepherds, well, a lot of the shepherds were dead, and so these animals would just become feral, and they could become quite a problem. In Amos 7, 14 and 15, we get a little bit of background about him. And he says, "I was a sheep breeder and a tender of sycamore fruit." Then he says, "Then the Lord took me as I followed the flock." Now, everything we read about as far as shepherds go is that they're leading the flock. They hear his voice and they follow him wherever he goes. When a flock got so big, when it became too much for one shepherd, they would take some young men or young boys, or relatively, you know, old enough to sort of take care of themselves, and these guys would follow the flock as under-shepherds, and they took a lot of the responsibility from the shepherd as far as encouraging, picking up the weak. They could help with sheep that were about to give birth, etc., etc. These were under-shepherds, and so by default, the shepherd became then the chief shepherd. So none of these words that we read about and are used in either the Old or the New Testament are used by accident. So when Peter calls Jesus the chief shepherd, what is he inferring? That he's an under-shepherd, and that the elders then of each congregation are also under-shepherds. They're not the chief shepherd. They don't have his responsibility. The sheep aren't following his voice, their voice. They're following the chief shepherd's voice. But they are there to help encourage the flock to follow, to keep up with the shepherd. The patriarchs were all shepherds, as far as we can tell. And one last bit of outside extra-biblical information that I came across that was not related to this study, but I was doing some work on chronology and archaeology in the Old Testament and things like that. And I came across this tidbit of information that from the time that Abraham would have entered Canaan to the time that the Babylonian captivity occurred over 1,000 years later, at no time were any less than one half of the Israelite population shepherds. And we know this because we can tell in the archaeology that at least half of the population continued to live a nomadic existence. Shepherding required nomadism, or at least what's called semi-nomadism, in the Old Testament. So anytime you read from Saul on, basically, that the men returned to their tents, that's talking about people that lived a nomadic lifestyle and were probably involved primarily in shepherding. It was such a major part of their economy and so necessary for daily living for all that time that no less than half the population ever settled down in a city. The people that you read about that are connected to a place, like Saul of Gibeah, Jesse of Bethlehem, etc., etc., these tended to be upper-class types who actually had landed property and had vineyards. So if someone's name is connected to a vineyard, or if someone's name is connected to a threshing floor, etc., etc., these tended to be upper-class types. But your typical garden variety shepherd family was probably not nearly as well off by this time. This is well past the days of Abraham, where these would have been the, what we might call the chief citizens of the people. Now, I'm not a betting man at all, but if I were, if you recall the 6,000 in Israel that would not bend the knee to Baal, I'm going to go ahead and take a guess that a lot of those people would have been these nomadic shepherding types, because when we start packing people into city, we start shedding our virtue really quick. I don't know why that is necessarily. The Bible addresses some things about that, but I'm going to guess that a lot of those people, those men who would not bow the knee to Baal, were these nomadic shepherd types. I'm going to go ahead and begin to start wrapping up with just one thought. In both John chapter 10 and in Genesis, we have outlined for us the importance of shepherding. In the Old Testament, of course, God is compared to the shepherd. And he's spoken of as the superlative shepherd who feeds, waters, leads, watches over, cares for, seeks out, rescues, gathers, binds up, strengthens, and carries. All of these are pastoral activities. These are all things that are related to the task and responsibilities of shepherding. Jesus, in the New Testament, this is transferred to him. It would seem to me, I can't prove this, but if God gave Adam and his sons the knowledge of how to domesticate and tend sheep, it seems to me he also probably gave them the knowledge of the virtues of a good shepherd. And that there may have been some type of lesson in there for them of what to expect from God should they choose to heed his voice as opposed to others. You recall in the book of Judges, several times it says, now there was no king in Israel. What did the men do at that time? Basically whatever they wanted. God gave us Jesus Christ as a shepherd. And all the qualities, all the virtues of a good shepherd are found in Jesus. And I think these qualities were known from an early, early time. That's why we find them expounded upon and praised in even pagan cultures that have really little, if anything, to do with the Bible. That's because we automatically, as human beings, we gravitate towards people that are good, and people that are courageous, and people that are loyal, and people that are nurturing. And I know nurturing is kind of something we associate with femininity, but in the Bible, that's absolutely not the case. Anyone can be nurturing. Anyone can be compassionate. Anyone can be willing to lend a hand and help up. And that's a good example for us. So when we are looking for our own pastors, our own shepherds in our congregations, you'll notice the types of qualities that God expects them to be able to have on our behalf. And they're all these qualities that we see, of course, in the shepherd. That's my time. I hope this was useful for you. And look forward to hearing the other lessons this weekend. Thank you.